it's just a beautiful thing to have this honor of getting jobs like this where you can produce something that makes people happy in some way.
Whether you're settling down to an icy Negroni or pouring yourself an Americano, a bar simply isn't complete without the classic bitter Campari. But while the famous bottle needs no introduction, transforming such a classic brand into a physical space can be a tricky task. We'll speak to the designer behind Campari's first dedicated drinking space today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm Ben Rylan. Also today,
I think in the 1940s especially is when people started to wearing jeans as more casual wear. I think that started maybe with the GIs, then was like picked up by Hollywood and, you know, James Dean, Marlon Brando.
Trends come and go, but denim, it seems, is here to stay. We'll suss out the secrets to successful longevity with Levi's Vintage. And
you go to the hospital, you're hoping to get better, and first thing you do is you put on this gown that reminds you that something's wrong with you. And I just felt like that was something that we could fix and help.
We'll find out how rethinking the age-old design of the hospital gown is, among other things, helping to prevent the accidental exposure of one's bare derriere. All that coming up right here on Section D. Campari is a strong and well-known brand with an instantly recognizable visual identity that stretches far beyond the deep, red, bitter aperitif. It's a main player in bars across the world and in the pages of luxury magazines. When Campari decided to transplant the brand's visual aesthetic to its own dedicated bar in Vienna, they called upon local designer Laura Karaczynski. Crafting a modern physical space that evokes Campari's rich heritage was certainly no easy task, but as Laura told Monocle's Alexei Korolev just before Christmas, like mixing the perfect drink, designing the space was all about quality ingredients and knowing your product.
Hi, my name is Laura. I'm an art directrice and designer from Vienna. I have my own design agency here since almost 10 years, and today we're going to talk about a little project we did for Campari.
Laura Karaczynski was first approached by Campari last year when the Italian drinks firm opened a pop-up bar in Vienna, its first ever in the world. The project proved a success, and when the company decided to do a similar thing in Austria's second city of Graz, it once again called on Laura's services.
It all started with another project last year we did in the heart of Vienna at Schwarzes Kamel, which is a deli, you can say, and we did a bar Campari there. And the brothers from Graz saw it in Vienna and they were so mesmerized by it. So they asked Campari if they can do it themselves as well in Graz. So we went there. It already existed, the whole shop. So we had already the beautiful terrazzo floors and we had the beautiful details where you can hang stuff. And it was beautifully finished already by the architect from there. We painted the whole ceiling red in our main color and put a few extra lights and highlighted the whole interior a bit more with extra LED, like red LED lightning and some spots.
But all the furniture, you
the
know,
furniture, the bar in this particular project, the furniture was already there. So we added also the curtains and of course the logo and placed a lot of merchandising in the shelves.
But it is a temporary project.
It started as a temporary project, but it will be not temporary anymore from next year. So they would leave it there. And the other one, the first one where everything was custom made and the Schwarzes Kamel, where nothing existed before, it was like a rough site. There we built everything from scratch. And it was built in 1 week at a very low budget. So we had to tweak a bit, but it was the first bar Campari ever that led to the bar Campari at Frankowitz.
Okay, now back to the design. So in front of us we have, that's a box for a bottle. These are...
wrapping paper.
Again, you know, the red from the...
it's an own Campari Pantone code they use. I don't know it exactly right now, but it's their signature red they use. And we designed some packaging for the concept in Graz, which is daily meets aperitivo bar. And so we had the opportunity to do little packaging, like for the bottles. We did some baguette paper because the shop in Graz also is known for little breads they sell, like a Schwarzes Kamel with different toppings. We did some wrapping paper. We also did, actually, we did some cups as well for the winter time, because now in Graz we redecorated again the whole place to look more like a Italian winter wonderland with lots of lights and sparkly red shining things. So it's a lot of fun to do these custom supermarket style visuals for such a big brand.
Laura's agency was also in charge of refurbishing Campari's offices in Vienna, and she says it's a humbling experience to work with such a well-known brand.
To be honest, I'm very thankful to be working with Campari because they are fully trusting us after their first bar was such a success. And also with the interior design of their offices, we tried to in some way give back all the trust that they gave us. It's just a beautiful thing to have this honor of getting jobs like this where you can produce something that makes people happy in some way. So I think our job is to really listen well and also be accepting of rules, like in case of colors or ideas they have and want to see. And as long as this is going well, I think that's the best thing that could happen.
Alexei Korolev taking us inside Bar Campari in Vienna with designer Laura Karaczynski. As things heat up, or cool down, as it might be, for next month's Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, US network NBC has unveiled a fresh new set design housed inside a 3,500-square-foot geodesic dome. The massive space utilizes a 40-by-16-foot LED video wall by technological design firm Leonard, as well as 15 HD graphic monitors. It's one of 13 studio sets to be used during the network's coverage, one of which also includes its own skating rink, all designed by Brian Higgison and his team at HD Studio in New York. The Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Get in touch by emailing me, Ben Rylan, on br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Stay tuned. A visit to the hospital is rarely a pleasant experience, but for many patients, the unintended exposure of one's bare bottom can make the whole ordeal much worse. That was just one of the age-old gown gripes that healthwear company Care and Wear discovered when they partnered with students at the Parsons School of Design on a mission to restitch the common medical wearable. The new kimono-inspired design blends box pleats and a series of plastic snaps that provide ample coverage while also allowing for easy access for ad hoc treatments. Chaitanya Razdan is a co-founder and the chief executive of Care and Wear.
I guess you could say it started when I was 2 years old in the hospital for the first time that I can remember. Obviously, I'd been there before earlier, but every time for better or worse, was in the hospital a lot, had operations a number of times, broken number of bones. And then my mom was also a physician, so spent a lot of time kind of chasing her around and probably terrorizing all the nurses and doctors in the hospital. And every time I was there, I was just amazed and kind of uncomfortable of how you were exposing your backside to everyone in the hospital and kind of in general, just the experience, right? Like you go to the hospital, you're hoping to get better, and all of a sudden, first thing you do is you put on this gown that reminds you that something's wrong with you. And I just felt like that was something that we could fix and help. And there's been so many studies on how like the color of the wall impacts your treatment process. I've always been amazed that no one's really ever focused on what you're actually wearing, and something that's going to be on you 24/7 while you're in the hospital can have such a profound impact. And so I guess that was the initial impetus for it. And then when we were talking to Parsons about co-teaching a class with them and having the opportunity to work with some of the world's leading and upcoming fashion designers, we felt that there was an incredible, we wanted to do something meaningful and something big. And with over 589 million people that are admitted into a hospital annually, we just felt there was an incredible opportunity to make a large difference with a patient gown.
I suppose part of the problem then must be that when we talk about issues that affect hospitals and people who are in hospital, it's often down to some sort of quite serious medical question. We don't often really think about some of the design-related queries that can pop up. And as you suggested there, something as simple as the color of a wall can really significantly impact how someone feels when they're in hospital. How did you find reactions when you were first suggesting this idea of giving the hospital gown a bit of a redesign?
Everyone we spoke to from a patient side was saying, yes, please. And I think everyone we spoke to on the clinician side said, yes, but there's got to be a reason it hasn't changed in forever. And so as we dug deeper, we found that cost was a huge component, as well as the laundry and facilities. So being able to wash the gown and have it last through 300 plus degree temperature water and dryer was going to be really important. And the iron, as well as things like the snaps on the sleeves and kind of how you wear it and making it easy for someone to understand. Because for better or worse, the current gown that you have, everyone knows how to put it on because you literally just put it on with the backside open and then you get someone to tie it for you. So making something that could really make the same difference but not cost the hospital system anymore was going to be super important. And that was kind of what people questioned whether we'd be able to do. And I think how we approached it and how we approach everything is our comprehensive design process. So trying to marry function and fashion together by having designers, clinicians, and patients all together and working on the same solution so that you're making it something that clinically can work, but that a patient also wants to wear, but that also from a cost perspective can work as well.
And how detailed did you get when you were looking at the redesign process? Obviously, looking at your design, I can see that it's in some part come from the inspiration behind a kimono. That's sort of spoken to how you formed the shape of the gown. What about some of the other details, such as the ties that you mentioned, the clips on the sleeves, even the type of fabric and color?
Yeah, so the ties are pretty cool. First of all, there's two sets of ties so that you can get to your chest without having to take off the robe and expose your entire body. Secondly, the ties have thumb slits so that if you don't have strong dexterity in your fingers or you don't have the ability to tie it completely strongly, you can just put your finger or thumb into the hole and use that to tie it up. The snaps that were used were all plastic. The reason for using plastic snaps is so that you can do an MRI. In the back, there's still access to the back, and it opens up, providing you that access that some people might need for a stethoscope, etc. Having the box stitch be where it was and located where it was important to ensure that the backside wasn't open. And then finally, I think kind of as you mentioned, having something that you can feel good in, and we just felt that kimono would add a little dignity and also ease for the patients as well.
As far as a patient goes, one might expect they'd look at your design for the hospital gown and think, well, this is absolutely better than the status quo. But what about the professional side of things as well? One would expect that when you're talking about doctors and nurses and other hospital staff that are dealing with so many patients on a daily basis, they might simply be tempted to go with the status quo, the easy option, that being the existing hospital gown. How do you see the challenge of convincing professionals that, no, this is actually a better option?
Yeah, so it's a fantastic question. I think first, there's two answers to that. First is on the professional side and the clinician side, they are people too. And almost every doctor or nurse or person in the laundry and facilities, et cetera, has at some point either been in the hospital, whether it's for them or their loved ones. And so everyone knows that there is a problem, and this is something that everyone's been passionate to solve. And then I think the second is having them a part of the process. So I think where a lot of people historically have failed is they'll try or not been as successful. They'll try and find a solution, but they're not working with all the key stakeholders. And so we had clinicians and experts from hospitals such as NYU Langone, New York Presbyterian, Massachusetts General, the Cleveland Clinic, Catholic Medical, Centara, University of Miami, and others involved throughout the entire class cycle. And that was really important to make sure that their feedback was not just given, but also followed on and kind of taught the students just how important it is to get their feedback as well.
So next time you're checking into the hospital, then chat, will you be bringing your own hospital gown?
I guess, well, if the hospital's not a customer, ideally each and every hospital around the world will be contacting us and utilizing our gowns. And I think the other reason for that is also reduction of SKUs. So currently hospitals have 9+ SKUs of different types of gowns. So they'll have a telemetry gown, they'll have an IV gown, et cetera. And our goal was to bring all the gowns into one so that you technically, as a hospital, are reducing your cost while providing a better experience for your patients.
Well, I'm sure that hospital staff who are a little bit sick of seeing bare backsides everywhere they look will be thanking you at the very least.
Exactly. That's the hope.
Chaitanya Razdan there, co-founder and chief executive of Care and Wear. The new year has arrived, which means the fashion calendar is quickly filling up. Next week, we'll touch down in the epicenter of men's fashion, Florence, for Pitti Uomo. For now, though, we're off to the United States, where, of course, Levi Strauss and Company is widely credited for bringing blue jeans to the masses since denim was developed as a workwear staple in 1873. Since then, the brand's designs have evolved and developed. But Levi's vintage offshoot is responsible for digging through the company's 20,000-strong archive to recreate iconic pieces and ensure that they're never forgotten. Monocle's Daphne Karnesis spoke to the man at the helm of Levi's Vintage, Paul O'Neill, who explains now why jeans might fade in the wash, but never from the fashion pages.
My name is Paul O'Neill. I'm the head of design at Levi's Vintage Clothing. I think jeans originally were created as a workwear garment for miners and other labourers, and they were born out of a necessity. Jeans originally were worn over trousers, and they were known as waist overalls. And Levi's first produced jeans in 1873 for miners, and the miners would go down to the mine shaft and the jeans would be hanging on the wall. They'd put them over their trousers, they'd go do their work, they'd come back and they'd hang them up, and off they went. And I think, you know, as time evolved, this workwear became, you know, something that transformed into, I think in the 1940s especially, is when people started to wearing jeans as more casual wear. I think that started maybe with the GIs that were off duty, and they would just wear jeans and they'd wear like an underwear garment as a t-shirt. And this was something that then was like picked up by Hollywood and, you know, James Dean, Marlon Brando, and which eventually led on to teenagers wearing jeans and white t-shirts in the 50s and started this kind of rebel youth style. I think the 501 has been cited as being the biggest selling product of all time. And yeah, now jeans are every man's product, and I think, you see 8 out of 10 people on the street are wearing jeans.
That was going to be my next question to you about the Levi's jeans of the 1940s and why they captured people's imagination so much.
Once they became like a casual wear item as opposed to like a strictly a workwear item, and again in the 1940s there was a lot of changes with World War II, there was rationing, which kind of helped the 501 evolve a lot. I mean, it was stripped from certain metal sundries were removed from the garments to conserve for the war. I think, in my estimation, the fabric, like the jeans, became slimmer in the 1940s. And that, again, is maybe due to, you know, conserving fabrics. And that's something that then never changed. So when we came back from the war, the jeans were a little bit more automated, the way they were constructed. There was, you know, definitely a bit more focus on, you know, mass production. The slim silhouette never went away. And I mean, I think in around 1947, when we started to automate the production of jeans, this is the classic 501. And I think since that, not really anything has changed since 1947 and the 501. And we call this like kind of the first modern jean. And I think a lot of companies have based their jeans on this model of the 501.
And how often do you dig out the archive and select certain vintage pieces to recreate?
Well, every season, you know, that's one of the main focuses of my job. So every season, I'll come up with a concept to build a collection around. So what we do at Levi's Vintage Clothing is very focused on reproducing the history of the brand. So we've started producing jeans in 1873. And our archive has over 20,000 products from 1873 up until today. So, like, the first port of call for my job is to come up with a concept. That concept is usually about a piece of American history, a snapshot of American history. That concept could be sparked from a book that I've read or a record I listened to, or it could also be sparked from something we've just acquired in the archive, a really exciting product or a really exciting piece. And once the concept's established, I'll do a lot of research on imagery to try and establish the look we're looking for. And then I'll go to the archive and I'll dig through, pull the relevant pieces to help me tell this story for the collection.
And how do you go about keeping up with the changing technology and new materials and integrating that into your vintage designs?
That's interesting because I think it's the opposite for us. So we're trying to push back against this technology and the modern machinery, and we're constantly looking for the, you know, the old shuttle looms that can produce the fabric in the way it was done originally, or we're also looking for the old machinery and the old chain stitch machines. So it's more of a struggle. We're trying to fight technology in a way, and we're always striving to produce things as they were done originally.
How has the cut of your jeans changed over time if you look at the brand as a whole?
We started to make jeans, as I said, in 1873. At that stage, the jean was like quite a wide fit, high-waisted. It was worn over trousers, so it wasn't worn next to the body. It had four pockets. That evolved in 1901. We added the fifth pocket. In 1922, we added belt loops. The jean still had this wide fit. In 1936, we added the red tab, which was something was an iconic kind of marker for us and a branding exercise. In 1937, we added the hidden rivets on the garments. Before that, the rivets were exposed. All in this time, the garments are still kind of a wide fit silhouette, but there's all these subtle changes going along. And that's what we're trying to capture with LVC, with the timeline of the 501 that we have. We have around 8 or 9 garments in the collection at the moment, starting from 1890, that go right up to 1976. And they kind of hit on all these key changes throughout the history of the 501. As I said earlier, it's like around the 1940s where the 501 becomes slimmer. I think once it becomes like slim and this kind of straight cut around 1944, that's kind of the evolution of the fit doesn't really alter so much. I think the big change is going from this wider fit where people were wearing it over the garments until a slimmer fit where people were wearing it more casual and next to the body. After 1947, throughout the 50s, any fit differences are very subtle within the garment. And I think even the current 501 in the mainline business now wouldn't be a million miles away from the 1947 501.
And I'm just curious, what are some of the oddest things that you found in the archive?
Well, one thing that comes to mind is when I first joined Levi's, which was 2009, and it was one of my first trips to the archive. You know, it was super exciting for me. I'd never seen anything in the archive before, so it was like my boss at the time asked me, was there anything I wanted to see? And I didn't know where to start, but I wanted to see all the precious things, but I also wanted to see anything kind of quirky, and I'm really into like mid-century stuff. So we pulled out this product called the Spikes.
They're known as the Spikes.
The Spikes, yeah. And the Spikes, the name was due to the silhouette. They had this like super very tapered silhouette that was a very small like cuff opening at the bottom, but like quite a wide top lock. And they were known as the Jello Spikes. they came in three colours that I had seen in the archive, and one was a fluorescent green, one was a fluorescent orange, and a fluorescent yellow. And they were from like the early 1950s, which looking at them was really kind of hard to believe because they seemed so modern and so fresh, and the colours were like just crazy, and I couldn't understand how somebody could be producing these in the 1950s. So yeah, they were really interesting, and they were called the Jell-O spikes because at the time the sales guys were going around with like packs of Jell-O.
Really?
The gelatine, and they had like the lemon, lime and orange, and they were like sitting alongside the garments, and I think there was some promotion with Jell-O. And I thought that was really interesting. So we reproduced them, I think it was spring 14, as part of the collection. And that was really exciting because they were so unusual and nobody could believe they were from that period. And another story that went along with them, that in the 1950s when they didn't sell so well, that all the remaining stock was taken back and was overdyed black in a factory in Texas and then resold.
Give a new life.
Give a bit of a more commercial like life to these products. So in tradition of what we do at LVC, we also took back all of the garments that didn't sell in the Jell-O colours in spring 14, and we overdyed them all black and put them into the next collection. So it was kind of fun, and it was kind of a nod to that story.
Paul O'Neill from Levi's Vintage speaking to Daphne Karnesis. Next week, do join us. We're off to Pitti Uomo in Florence. Section D is researched by Daphne Karnesis and edited by Christy Evans. I'm Ben Rylan. Bye for now.